Hello and welcome to another edition of the Advent AM podcast, Risk and Business. And today I'm delighted to be joined by a very special guest, James Morris. James is currently leading the Cybersecurity and Business Resilience Policy Group and has been a long-time friend and contributor to Advent AM's podcasts over the years. So, James, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And yourself?
Yeah, doing well. Lots going on in the cybersecurity space as we speak.
Good. So maybe just start by giving our audience a brief background into what your new role is with the CSBR.
Yeah. So I'm the director of the CSBR, previously being a member of parliament 14 years, as you know, and we launched about a year ago. The formal launch was in the House of Lords last November. We're trying to drive policy ideas across the whole sort of cybersecurity and resilience space. It's a very, very pertinent issue for the country at the moment. We had the problems with Heathrow over the weekend. There's been problems at Jaguar Land Rover. It continues to be a very top topic. So we're kind of celebrating our first anniversary of kind of interventions in this space, I suppose.
So how have things been going? There seems to have been a lot of activity. Maybe give us an insight into what the CSBR has been up to, what the current topics are that the CSBR is getting most interested in.
Yeah, so we kind of set out our stall. The work we've been doing in the first 6-7 months of the year, we started off by interrogating what we know about the Cybersecurity and Resilience Bill. So far, we've had a policy statement issued by DCIT, still awaiting the actual publication of the bill itself. We kind of think it must be imminent, but there's been delays. As you know, there's been a change of minister responsible for that bill in the recent reshuffle. So we did a session on the Cybersecurity Resilience Bill, identifying some of the key questions and issues that we thought kind of arose out of the policy statement. And we produced a paper off the back of that and have been kind of talking about it in parliamentary forums, briefing people on what we think the issues are on the Cybersecurity Resilience Bill. And when the bill is actually finally published, we're going to do some further work, because obviously when it's published, it'll be still in a relatively early state as it starts to go through its parliamentary passage. And, we'll be looking to see where we can continue to suggest amendments or suggest changes to the bill. At the moment, what's come out is, I suppose, not that much detail. I mean, the policy statement went into, some aspects of it. So we've done some work around that. And we also launched this program, which you've been involved in, around AI in healthcare, because we thought that was an important kind of general issue, because in terms of kind of government and public policy, obviously the NHS is absorbing a huge amount of public money. And the recent 10-year NHS plan that the government produced was very much looking at AI and technology as helping in a transformation of the NHS and in the health service more generally. And AI is being talked about as being capable of helping in that transformation, but it raises lots of issues about innovation, lots of issues about governance and security. So we published a paper in around May, June time, which was about how to break down the barriers to innovation around AI in the NHS. And then a couple of weeks ago, a paper authored by your good self in collaboration with us on the kind of cybersecurity governance and security issues that arise. So that's been, that's been a pretty fertile debate, and actually it's been very, it has coincided with the publication of this NHS plan and some wider plans. So it's been very relevant. We've also done some work around the Data Use and Access Bill when that was going through its passage through Parliament. That's now got royal assent, but some of the kind of implications of the data use and access bill and what it's actually going to mean in practice. So we have been sort of in discussions about, you know, what are the opportunities in detection of cybercrime and policing with the new bill, the data use and access bill. We're obviously very interested at the moment in the debates around digital identity, which are going on within government, with lots of discussion about that. So there's been a lot going on. So, you know, we're pretty happy with the progress we've made. Our mission is to, you know, come up with practical policy and influence the debate and influence decision makers. And I think, you know, our early work is certainly doing that, or certainly contributing to that.
And it's not a political organization. It's very much about bringing together industry, academia, and politics to approach these topic areas in a very sensible, well-informed, with subject matter expertise wrapped around it.
Exactly. It's not political. We're, you know, it's a non-partisan policy center. So, you know, we're interested in interesting ideas, what works, as you say, collaborating with business, with academia, positioning ourselves at the centre of that debate. So no, it's not. We're not partisan. We're not coming at this from an ideological perspective. We're coming at it from a what works perspective and what we need to do.
And coming back to the AI in healthcare, then maybe just give our listeners a brief understanding of why that was a topic area that we chose to focus in on as an area of importance. And as you've said, you know, our work does coincidentally come about at the same time that the government has published its 10-year plan. So it's a very good timing for that. But in particular, where do you see the challenges for AI and healthcare coming from?
Yeah, and I think the stimulus for it was obviously there'd been some high profile ransomware attacks on NHS infrastructure. There was a lot of debate about the nature of the technology platforms in the NHS, which were kind of bubbling up. And the overall driver, again, as I said at the beginning, was given that the NHS is going to be absorbing up to about a third of all public expenditure by the end of the decade, how can the problem statement is, how can AI and applications of our AI help in making the NHS more productive? How can we build patient trust? Can AI help in making the NHS more sustainable? Because if action isn't taken, or we can't transform some of the models of the NHS, it's probably going to become unsustainable financially in the medium term. I mean, as I say, beginning to absorb, you know, north of £200 billion a year. So that kind of combination of factors led us to think actually, it's quite a big topic, looking at the kind of the operation of a key part of our public sector infrastructure, which has been vulnerable to cyber attacks. Plays a critical role in our, you know, social and economic life. It's a critical lifeline for people. It's got its financial and, you know, patient challenges. So that's one of the reasons why we thought it would be a good topic for us to look at.
So when people hear the term AI in healthcare, quite often they immediately think of diagnosis. Very commonly things like chatbots. What areas in healthcare are we seeing AI already making an impact, and where do you see it as being the most aspirational?
Well, the area that immediately strikes me is around radiology. So you have seen the application of AI in radiology, in the detection of lung cancers and so on. Its efficacy in identification and diagnosis in that space seems to be developing and is quite well proven. You know, it can speed up diagnosis in that area, and you know, can help with throughput. So I think you're beginning to see that the impact of that. I've seen quite a few examples of where that is starting to make a big difference. But as you say, I mean, you know, AI has the potential in a number of different areas. As you say, the sort of the kind of common wisdom would be, how do you apply AI to, for example, making a GP's life easier in terms of transcribing notes? Now, that can have an administrative impact. So, you know, the way that I see it is that there's kind of a portfolio of applications or operations within the NHS. You've got the admin functions, you've got the medical and the diagnosis functions, and you've got some kind of strategic functions, which I would say contain things like, how can we use AI to improve data analytics and the interrogation of the data repository we have within the NHS? Because, you know, we have this rich source of data, but how good are we at actually understanding it? Can AI help us with that? And then there's another box, which is kind of, I suppose, the blue sky box, which is, you know, lots of recent debate about AI's ability to help with drug discovery, which is kind of an emerging area. So I think AI can operate in all of these boxes, and you're beginning to see some applications in all of them. Some of them maybe more proven than others. So you're beginning to see it circulate into that kind of operational portfolio within the NHS. But the critical challenge is how to embed it, and how to make that, and, you know, make sure that diffusion happens in each of the quadrants, if that's a way of describing it.
Yes, it's important to sort of talk about that, actually, because AI is multifaceted, and it can be very easy to think of AI in one box, but actually it operates in so many different areas. As you said, you know, analytics and number crunching and predictive analysis. And there's a huge amount of heavy lifting that AI can do on behalf of the NHS, as well as with the right data and the right quality of data, improving analysis and diagnosis as well. But the NHS, obviously, there are particular sensitivities within the NHS and within healthcare in a wider context in terms of both data privacy and medical confidence that also need to be maintained. And you mentioned trust. We must bring the public along with us and ensure that trust is maintained. So I think things like transparency, explainability, ethics all have to be front and center in the debate as we go into this. And of course, the governance has to be got right as well. And it's only recently there was a high profile story about GPs using unapproved AI tools for interviews and transcriptions. And if we're not careful, then the adoption of the technology will race ahead of the governance.
And that's sort of where you came in terms of the paper that you authored with us in that we published a couple of weeks. Just wonder whether it might be worth you just talking a little bit about that, because I think you picked up in there some of the, you know, we can get very excited about AI's applications in all kinds of different areas. But as you say, because it's such a rapidly moving, accelerating, emerging technology, we've got real challenges around security, governance and ethics. So just wondered whether you might just talk a little bit about what you thought the key issues were that came out in the paper that you published.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it's worth starting off by saying that very often the governance, the risk, the compliance and the assurance activities are so often seen as brakes on the adoption of new or novel technologies. But I think that is usually because the technology is already often sprinting before the GRC team have heard the starter's gun. And actually, if we're there on the start line with everybody else and we're going forward as a team, then it becomes much more of a collaborative rather than a combative approach. It is really important, I think, as when we adopt any new or novel technology, particularly when we're introducing those technologies into healthcare, that we get the governance right, that we have thoroughly tested the security implications, the governance, the risk, the privacy, and we've aligned with medical in confidence, that we've got medical practitioners on board who understand the technology and can therefore explain it to the patient adequately. And I think if we use standards like ISO 42001, which is a new international standard for the governance, ethics, and risk management of AI in its broadest sense, combine that with things like the MHRA AI sandbox, tools like DTAC, and use regulation that exists for adoption of new medicines and new technologies and repurpose it effectively, then actually we can be part of the conversation and we can achieve that transparency, and therefore we can get the trust of the patient from day one.
And just on that, you talked about the MHRA sandbox and whatever. I mean, so we're not talking about kind of a blank sheet of paper here in terms of the regulation and governance. There are already, I mean, the MHRA has tried to change some of its modus operandi in order to kind of, you know, facilitate innovation and whatever. But do you think more needs to happen in that area to kind of both help with the innovation piece, but also to, because we need to kind of accelerate things, but not to the extent of creating chaos?
That's right, absolutely. And so the methodology and the application is already there. We don't have to create that from a blank sheet of paper, as you say. What we do need to do, though, is get better at using it and make sure that the process is swift enough that it isn't seen as the blocker or the break, and whilst at the same time being thorough enough that we can exit the sandbox with a level of confidence that we can then move into live application. And that's always going to be a fine balancing point. Similar thing goes for the ICO sandbox. You know, it's a great application that they've set up for testing new or novel technologies that be processing the wider content of personal information, but it also needs to move at a rate of pace that allows a new technology to get into the marketplace without being stifled or running out of funding and backers.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose it's also, I mean, one of the things that came to my mind was when you were speaking there is that, you know, the government discussions with the US that happened in the recent Trump visit, just to sort of, there's a lot of talk about investment in AI infrastructure in the UK, lots of US-UK cooperation. But the issue that sort of sprung to my mind when I was looking at that in relation to the kind of subjects we're talking about now was, you know, you're talking about the big players again. You're talking about OpenAI, you're talking about Microsoft, you're talking about, and actually part of the challenge is about how we can kind of get some, without wanting to sound parochial, Mike, some sort of homegrown innovation going, and how organizations like the NHS can become more adept at adopting and supporting that homegrown innovation. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, well, there's a lot made of it in the press about how this was going to enable UK innovation. It was going to create UK growth. But as you say, a lot of it is about creating footholds in the UK for US technologists. It's not about developing new or novel technologies here in the UK. And it's hard to see how you balance those two up. Yes, that's where the money's going to come from big tech. But big tech has historically been very covetous of its ownership. There's an ongoing debate, and we've had it ourselves within the CSBR around data residency versus data sovereignty. As soon as you start putting UK healthcare data into a big US AI tool, then there will be US ownership of that data. And for decades, the US have been champing their bits to get hold of UK data because we have such a unique healthcare system. So I think we do need to be careful about the taking of the money to build the UK economy and then giving away our crown jewels in return. And we have a long history of innovation and entrepreneurship here in the UK. what we haven't been so good at is having the wraparound support that enables the idea to go from concept into reality and having the funding stream that supports that all the way through. So what often happens is we get to a point where the innovator then has to look for venture capitalism. Venture capitalism money often comes from the States. And the next thing we know is the company's up and rooted and moved to Silicon Valley. And so we lose that ability once again for it to be a UK invention.
And I mean, I've taken this down a slightly kind of tangential segue from where we're talking about, but coming, because I think it does have a little bit of impact on the, on this, the discussion around AI and security and innovation, because as you alluded to, the kind of patient trust element of this is quite critical. And AI, I think, to quite a lot of people who are not kind of immersed in it, who maybe come and kind of interact it with the first time, is it can feel quite remote. It can feel quite impersonal. What's going to happen to my data? You know, do I trust a piece of AI to be making a diagnostic decision that might lead me to have, you know, treatment of a certain sort? To what extent the human beings still need to be involved in this process? How do we manage all of that? So yeah, I think it raises, you know, quite a few issues around the kind of the absolutely fundamental thing, which is about patient trust, but also I suppose clinician and workforce trust within the NHS itself, that that you can utilize these tools and you know, they're grounded.
Oh, definitely. So I think workplace training is going to be absolutely vital to the development of this. We need to have all clinicians, not just clinicians, but all staff understanding what the AI tools are and how they work so that they themselves trust it and that they can then have the ability to translate that into language that the patients will understand. But we also need to make sure that before that happens, we've got meaningful clinical validation and real world testing. And what does that real world testing look like in practice? And then there's the assurance that we need to give from a patient's perspective as to what safeguards we're making around their data and their healthcare. And why should they trust the computer over the doctor, who is the most trusted person in a healthcare environment? So there's a lot of stuff in there that I think comes back again to that trilogy of transparency, explainability, and ethics.
So in terms of the recommendations that you were making in your paper, what are the sort of top couple of recommendations that you think are the most important that we should be kind of pushing and looking at within this kind of whole topic that we've been discussing?
So I think key from the GRC perspective, key are the adoption and implementation of international standards like ISO 42001 and the supporting standards that go around it. And I'm not by any means saying that everybody should be getting certification to the standard, but using it as a framework to make sure that AI is adopted ethically and responsibly is absolutely vital. Use of supporting standards that allow us to make sure we get the surrounding governance right. And that means people at the very top of organizations from a leadership role understanding what AI means. And then making sure that we get risk management right so that we're considering risks, not just from a technical perspective, but from a societal and data and organization and patient perspective so that we cover all of those off in their totality. Using those existing capabilities like the sandbox to make sure that we test stuff before we go live with it. We need to be moving at pace with innovation, but we need to do that in a way that remains safe and secure for the patient as well. And given that so much of the NHS already relies on a huge and convoluted supply chain, then we must be considering the supply chain risks as part of that adoption.
Yeah, well, I think that point about the supply chain risks is very pertinent. As you say, it's an organization which is heavily dependent on a complex supply chain, and you know we're beginning to see whoever these bad actors are who are looking at things like transport supply chains and booking systems. You know, that's the key vulnerability that is being, you know, that is kind of developing the attack surface, as it were. So that becomes even more important in the context of this kind of accelerated world of AI interaction.
Absolutely. I mean, would you see the UK here as having an opportunity to be a leading light when it comes to AI and healthcare, rather than bringing up the rear or being left behind?
Well, I think we've got some, I mean, there's a couple of challenges. I mean, I think, you know, we've got a pretty vibrant tech sector in the UK. We've got innovative universities. We've got, you know, quite a good ecosystem. So I think we've got the potential for it. But the couple of challenges are, one is, as you know, as we'll know, the NHS, if the NHS is going to transform itself over the next 5 to 10 years, there's lots of bureaucratic obstacles to that happening. The workforce needs to change. So there are considerable barriers to leveraging the UK's kind of tech clusters and tech innovation into the NHS. The point we were making about the kind of, I think it's tempting, and I can, you know, the temptations to want to do deals with the US around building infrastructure, but we don't want to become a data warehouse for the US, you know, with some lovely infrastructure. So I think the answer to your question is, I think we have got the potential to do it, but there is a lot of counterbalancing, kind of countervailing forces, which we need to think about how we confront and change if we are going to achieve that. But I think the kind of the burning platform, as it were, which is that our public health system will become financially unsustainable unless it can transform the way that it goes about doing certain things, in terms of speed, in terms of innovation, in terms of delivering patient care, and not a lot of that money being absorbed in kind of bureaucratic processing. So we have got, you know, there is an urgency there because, the future of the UK's public finances depend on the NHS becoming a more sustainable platform.
So let me ask the question then, James. If we were to have this conversation again in a couple of years, what would you see as being the markers of AI in healthcare having been a success?
Well, I think you'd see, widespread adoption at the admin level. So I think people would be more confident, interacting in primary care, with and having a conversation about their own health with AI in a way which is concrete and productive, makes them feel comfortable. I think that you'd see that as a kind of order qualifier for that building up of patient trust. And then you'd see a more consistent, application of, in that kind of diagnosis box, you'd see a much more consistent adoption of, new approaches that have been through a better process and that they were, that they were solid. But they had diffused through the system so that there was a way of that kind of consistency being maintained. So we weren't just relying on a kind of innovative group doing something over here or an innovative group doing something over here, that you started to see a greater consistency of approach. And I think also that there was clear evidence that we were beginning to get a better grip and understanding all of the rich data we have within the NHS as a repository. And we're beginning to use it in a way that was, productive to healthcare, that it was accessible, comprehensible and secure. I mean, those are just two attempts at answering that question, but I think those will be the elements where you're building a kind of virtuous circle of confidence across that kind of portfolio of operation in the NHS.
Yeah, that virtuous circle, including learnings, has to be key to the success of this going forward, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure this debate will go on and on.
I'm sure there are. And I would say also the use of some of these standards in a way that is, that makes sense, not just to tick a box, not just to be able to tick the box that says we've done compliance, but to do compliance because it makes a real difference. Doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So James, what next for CSBR then? What's the future look like? What's on the horizon?
Yeah, we're looking at we're actually looking at doing something around transport. Actually, we've been talking about some of the issues, cybersecurity and other issues faced across the transport system, both rail, road, air travel, and whatever. So, in November, we're going to be doing a roundtable about cybersecurity issues in the transport sector, because I think that's very relevant just in terms of its vulnerability, but its position within critical national infrastructure. And we've been continuing to do some stuff about international cyber. We did a roundtable, if you remember, around the AUKUS relationship. We're probably going to do a series of follow-ups on that, because international cyber cooperation, as we've been discussing, the US and other countries, is quite an important dimension to how the UK positions itself, both in terms of the kind of regulatory environment, but in terms of innovation and sharing innovations. So we're going to be doing some more work looking at that, and this piece around digital identity and following up on the cyber security resilience bill as those things kind of emerge over the next few months. So it's quite a busy program.
Great time to be running a policy organization and looking to influence the future of UK's capability in the cybersecurity and business resilience space.
Yeah. Well, it is quite, I mean, it's a challenge because it's very fast, there's a very fast moving environment, and it's important that policy makes sense. We don't get caught up in that acceleration, because we want to try and make some sense out of the chaos. But yeah, it's a very interesting time, a very exciting time, but a very insecure time in a way, because we're seeing every week the manifestations of some of the problems and the issues that we're trying to talk about and solve. So yeah, it's an interesting ride, to say the least.
Well, some of our biggest brand names have been affected in recent months, haven't they? So it just goes to show that nobody's safe or immune from attack at the moment.
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
Any final thoughts, James, before we sign off for today?
No, I don't think so. I think this whole, a lot of these debates are going to run and run. Thank you for your contribution to the AI and healthcare stuff. It's been good working with you on that. I'm sure we'll pick up further bits and pieces out of that as we develop the work. So it's been great to talk.
One final question for me then. What would be your biggest call to action for policymakers and lawmakers for the future in protecting UK infrastructure?
I think that's a really good question. I think it's seeing the whole thing in an integrated way, that protection of critical national infrastructure, protecting critical national infrastructure, getting business and organizations to realize that it's an issue which is central to them, not something that could be devolved to kind of, the IT department, and that people are adopting standards and being transparent. It's all part of also a kind of the societal challenge in individual citizens realizing the threats and vulnerabilities that we face in a kind of whole of society approach. So all that combination, going right up to considerations of national security, because everything is kind of interrelated. And I think that needs to be that needs to be how policy gets driven. And that will affect the way that we approach regulation in the cybersecurity and resilience bill. It will affect the way that, we do public campaigns to try and mobilize opinion and citizens about taking cybersecurity seriously. It drives a lot of things. So that, as I've been thinking about this more and more, that's the kind of holistic policy approach I think that the country needs to adopt in order to be able to deal with these complex threats that we're currently grappling with.
Brilliant. I would agree with you, actually, on all of that. Thank you, James. Well, this has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. My guest today has been James Morris, Director at the CSBR Policy Group. Thank you for your time today, James. As always, if you've liked it, then let us know. If there's a topic you think we should be discussing, then also let us know. And don't forget to reach out and connect with us across all of our socials. Make sure you're also following CSBR on their socials and on LinkedIn. There's some useful policy stuff coming up for the future. And if you want to get involved, then reach out to James and let him know. Thank you very much for listening. I've been Mike Gillespie, Advent IM, Risk and Business Podcast.